the visions and these colors you speak of, seek to learn from them. Let the victim in his dying tell you what he can about life itself. If images of his long life trip before you, observe them, or rather savor them, yes, savor them. Devour them slowly as you do his blood. As for the colors, let them pervade you. Let the entire experience inundate you. That is, be both active and utterly passive. Make love to your victim, and listen always for the actual moment when the heart ceases to beat. You will feel an undeniably orgiastic sensation at this moment, but it can be overlooked. Dispose of the body after, or make certain that you have licked away all sign of the puncture wounds in the victim's throat. Just a little bit of your blood on the tip of your tongue will accomplish this. In Venice, dead bodies are common. You need not take such pains. But when we hunt in the outlying villages, then often you may have to bury the remains. I was eager for all these lessons. That we hunted together was a magnificent pleasure. I came to realize quickly enough that Marius had been clumsy in the murders he had committed for me to witness before I'd been transformed. I knew then, as perhaps I've made plain in this story, that he wanted me to feel pity for these victims. He wanted me to experience horror. He wanted me to see death as an abomination. But due to my youth, my devotion to him, and the violence done me in my short mortal life, I had not responded as he hoped. Whatever the case, he was now a much more skilled killer. We often took the same victim together, I drinking from the throat of our captive, while he fed from the man's wrist. Sometimes he delighted in holding the victim tightly for me, while I drank all of the blood. Being new, I was thirsty every night. I could have lived for three or more without killing, yes, and sometimes I did. But by the fifth night of denying myself, this was put to the test, I was too weak to rise from the sarcophagus. So what this meant was that, when and if I were ever on my own, I must kill at least every fourth night. My first few months were an orgy. Each kill seemed more thrilling, more paralyzingly delicious than the one which had gone before. The mere sight of a bared throat could bring about in me such a state of arousal that I became like an animal, incapable of language or restraint. When I opened my eyes in the cold, stony darkness, I envisioned human flesh. I could feel it in my naked hands, and I wanted it. And the night could have no other events for me until I had laid my powerful hands on that one which would be the sacrifice to my need. For long moments after the kill, sweet throbbing sensations passed through me as the warm, fragrant blood found all the corners of my body as it pumped its magnificent heat into my face. This, and this alone, was enough to absorb me utterly, young as I was. But Marius had no intention of letting me wallow in blood, the hasty young predator, with no other thought but to glut himself night after night. "You must really begin to learn history and philosophy and the law in earnest," he told me. "You are not destined for the University of Padua now. You are destined to endure." So after our stealthy missions were completed, and we returned to the warmth of the palazzo, he forced me to my books. He wanted some distance between me and Ricardo and the others anyway, lest they become suspicious of the change that had occurred. In fact, he told me they knew about the change, whether they realized it or not. Their bodies knew that I was no longer human, though it might take their minds some time to accept the fact. "Show them only courtesy and love, only complete indulgence, but keep your distance," Marius told me. "By the time they realize the unthinkable is the fact, you will have assured them that you are no enemy to them, that you are indeed Amadeo still, whom they love, and that though you have been changed, you yourself have not changed towards them." I understood this. At once I felt a greater love for Ricardo. I felt it for all of the boys. "But, Master," I asked, "don't you ever become impatient with them? That they think more slowly, that they are so clumsy? I love them, yes, but surely you see them in a more pejorative light even than I do." "Amadeo," he said softly, "they are all going to die." His face was charged with grief. I felt it immediately and totally, which was always the way with feelings now. They came on in a torrent and taught their lessons at once. "They are all going to die, yes, and I am immortal." After that, I could only be patient with them, and indeed I indulged myself in the manner in which I looked at them and studied them, never letting them know it, but glorying in all the details of them as if they were exotic, because they were going to die. There is too much to describe, too much. I can't find a way to put down all that became clear to me in the first few months alone. And there was nothing made known to me in that time which was not deepened afterwards. I saw process everywhere I looked. I smelled corruption, but I also beheld the mystery of growth, the magic of things blossoming and ripening, and in fact all process, whether towards maturity or towards the grave, delighted and enthralled me, except, that is, the disintegration of the human mind. My study of government and law was more of a challenge. Though reading was accomplished with infinitely greater speed and near instantaneous comprehension of syntax, I had to force myself to be interested in such things as the history of Roman law from ancient times, and the great code of the Emperor Justinian, called the Corpus Juris Civilis, which my master thought to be one of the finest codes of law ever written. "The world is only getting better," Marius instructed me. "With each century, civilization becomes more enamored of justice. Ordinary men make greater strides towards sharing the wealth which was once the booty of the powerful, and art benefits by every increase in freedom, becoming ever more imaginative, ever more inventive, and ever more beautiful." I could understand this only theoretically. I had no faith or interest in law. In fact, I had a total contempt in the abstract for my master's ideas. What I mean is, I didn't have contempt for him, but I had an underlying contempt for law and for legal institutions and governmental institutions that was so total that I did not even understand it myself. My master said that he understood it. "You were born in a dark, savage land," he said. "I wish I could take you back 200 years in time, to the years before Batu, the son of Genghis Khan, sacked the magnificent city of Kiev Rus, to the time when indeed the domes of its Santa Sophia were golden, and its people full of ingenuity and hope." I heard ad nauseam of that old glory. I said quietly, not wanting to anger him, "I was stuffed with tales of the olden times when I was a boy, in the miserable wooden house in which we lived, only yards from the frozen river. I listened to that rot as I shivered by the fire. Rats lived in our house. There was nothing beautiful in it but the icons and my father's songs. There was nothing but depravity there. And we speak now, as you know, of an immense land. You cannot know how big Russia is unless you have been there, unless you have traveled as I did with my father into the bitter cold northern forests to Moscow or to Novgorod, or east to Krakow." I broke off. "I don't want to think of those times or that place," I said. "In Italy one cannot dream of enduring such a place." "Amadeo, the evolution of law, of government, is different in each land and with each people. I chose Venice, as I told you long ago, because it is a great republic, and because its people are firmly connected to the Mother Earth, by the simple fact that they are all merchants and engaged in trade. I love the city of Florence because its great family, the Medici, are bankers, not idle, titled aristocrats who scorn all effort in the name of what they believe has been given them by God. The great cities of Italy are made by men who work, men who create, men who do. And on account of this, there is a greater compassion to all systems, and infinitely greater opportunity for men and women in all walks of life." I was discouraged by all this talk. What did it matter? "Amadeo, the world now is yours," my master said. "You must look at the larger movements of history. The state of the world will begin in time to oppress you, and you will find, as all immortals do, that you cannot simply shut your heart on it, especially not you." "Why so?" I asked a little crossly. "I think I can shut my eyes. What do I care if a man is a banker or a merchant? What do I care whether I live in a city which builds its own merchant fleet? I can look forever on the paintings in this palazzo, master. I have not yet begun to see all the details in the procession of the Magi. And there are so many others. And what of all the paintings in this city?" He shook his head. "The study of painting will lead you to the study of man. and the study of man will lead you to lament or celebrate the state of the world of men. I didn't believe it, but I was not allowed to change the curriculum. I studied as I was told. Now, my master had many gifts which I did not possess, but which he told me I would develop in time. He could make fire with his mind, but only if conditions were optimum. That is, he could ignite a torch already prepared with pitch. He could scale a building effortlessly, with only a few quick handholds on its windowsills, propelling himself upwards with graceful, darting motions, and he could swim to any depth of the sea. Of course his vampiric vision and his hearing were far more acute and powerful than my own, and while voices intruded upon me, he knew how to emphatically shut them out. I had to learn this, and indeed I worked at it desperately, for there were times when all Venice seemed nothing but a cacophony of voices and prayers. But the one great power he possessed, which I did not possess, was that he could take to the air and cover immense distances with great speed. This had been demonstrated to me many times, but almost always, when he had lifted me and carried me, he had made me cover my face, or he had forced my head down so that I couldn't see where we went and how. Why he was so reticent about it, I couldn't understand. Finally, one night, when he refused to transport us as if by magic to the island of the Lido, so that we could watch one of the nighttime ceremonies of fireworks and torch-lit ships on the water, I pressed the question. "It's a frightening power," he said coolly. "It's frightening to be unanchored from the earth. In the early stages, it is not without its blunders and disasters. As one acquires skill, rising smoothly into the highest atmosphere, it becomes chilling not only to the body but to the soul. It seems not preternatural, but supernatural." I could see he suffered over this. He shook his head. "It is the one talent which seems genuinely inhuman. I cannot learn from humans how best to use it. With every other talent, humans are my teacher. The human heart is my school. Not so with this. I become the magician, I become the witch or the warlock. It's seductive, and one could become its slave." "But how so?" I asked him. He was at a loss. He didn't even want to talk about it. Finally, he became just a little impatient. "Sometimes, Amadeo, you grill me with your questions. You ask if I owe you this tutelage. Believe me, I do not." "Master, you made me, and you insist on my obedience. Why would I read Abelard's History of My Calamities and the writings of Duns Scotus of Oxford University if you didn't make me do it?" I stopped. I remembered my father and how I never stopped throwing acidic words at him, fast answers and slurs. I became discouraged. "Master," I said, "just explain it to me." He made a gesture as if to say, "Oh, so simple, eh?" "All right," he went on. "It's this way. I can go very high in the air, and I can move very fast. I cannot often penetrate the clouds. They're frequently above me. But I can travel so fast that the world itself becomes a blur. I find myself in strange lands when I descend. And I tell you, for all its magic, this is a deeply jarring and disturbing thing. I am lost sometimes, dizzy, unsure of my goals or my will to live, after I make use of this power. Transitions come too quickly. That's it, perhaps. I never spoke of this to anyone. And now I speak to you, and you're a boy, and you can't begin to understand." I didn't. But within a very short time, it was his wish that we undertake a longer journey than any we'd made before. It was only a matter of hours, but to my utter astonishment, we traveled between sundown and early evening to the far city of Florence itself. There, set down in a wholly different world than that of the Veneto, walking quietly amongst an entirely different breed of Italian, into churches and palaces of a different style, I understood for the first time what he meant. Understand, I'd seen Florence before, traveling as Marius's mortal apprentice with a group of the others, but my brief glimpse was nothing to what I saw as a vampire. I had the measuring instruments now of a minor god. But it was night. The city lay under the usual curfew, and the stones of Florence seemed darker, more drab, suggestive of a fortress, the streets narrow and gloomy, as they were not brightened by luminescent ribbons of water, as were our own. The palaces of Florence lacked the extravagant Moorish ornament of Venice's showplaces, the high-gloss, fantastical stone facades. They enclosed their splendor, as is more common to Italian cities. Yet the city was rich, dense, and full of delights for the eye. It was, after all, Florence, the capital of the man called Lorenzo the Magnificent, the compelling figure who dominated Marius's copy of the great mural, which I had seen on the night of my dark rebirth, a man who had died only a few years before. We found the city unlawfully busy, though it was quite dark, with groups of men and women lingering about in the hard-paved streets, and a sinister quality of restlessness hung about the Piazza della Signoria, which was one of the most important of all the many squares of the town. An execution had taken place that day, hardly an uncommon occurrence in Florence, or Venice for that matter. It had been a burning. I smelled wood and charred flesh, though all the evidence had been cleared before night. I had a natural distaste for such things, which not everyone has, by the way, and I edged towards the scene cautiously, not wishing with these heightened senses to be jarred by some horrible remnant of cruelty. Marius had always cautioned us as boys not to enjoy these spectacles, but to place ourselves mentally in the position of the victim, if we were to learn the maximum from what we saw. As you know from history, the crowds at executions were often merciless and unruly, taunting the victim sometimes, I think, out of fear. We, the boys of Marius, had always found it terribly difficult to cast our mental lot with the man being hanged or burnt. In sum, he'd taken all the fun out of it for us. Of course, as these rituals happened almost always by day, Marius himself had never been present. Now, as we moved into the great Piazza della Signoria, I could see that he was displeased by the thin ash that still hung in the air and the vile smells. I also noticed that we slipped past others easily, two dark-draped, swiftly moving figures. Our feet scarce made a sound. It was the vampiric gift that we could move so stealthily, shifting quickly out of sudden and occasional mortal observation with an instinctive grace. "It's as though we're invisible," I said to Marius, "as if nothing can hurt us, because we don't really belong here and will soon take our leave." I looked up at the grim battlements that fronted on the square. "Yes, but we are not invisible. Remember it," he whispered. "But who died here today? People are full of torment and fear. Listen, there is satisfaction and there is weeping." He didn't answer. I grew uneasy. "What is it? It can't be any common thing," I said. "The city is too vigilant and unquiet." "It's their great reformer, Savonarola," Marius said. "He died on this day, hanged and then burnt here. Thank God he was already dead before the flames rose." "You wish mercy for Savonarola?" I asked. I was puzzled. This man, a great reformer in the eyes of some, perhaps, had always been damned by all I knew. He had condemned all pleasures of the senses, denying any validity to the very school in which my master thought all things were to be learnt. "I wish mercy for any man," said Marius. He beckoned for me to follow, and we moved toward the nearby street. We headed away from the grisly place. "Even this one, who persuaded Botticelli to heap his own paintings on the bonfires of the vanities?" I asked. "How many times have you pointed to the details of your own copies of Botticelli's work to show me some graceful beauty you wanted me to never forget?" "Are you going to argue with me until the end of the world?" said Marius. "I'm pleased that my blood has given you new strength in every aspect, but must you question every word that falls from my lips?" He threw me a furious glance, letting the light of nearby torches fully illuminate his half-mocking smile. "There are some students who believe in this method, and that greater truths rise out of the continued strife between teacher and pupil, but not me. I believe you need to let my lessons settle in quiet, at least for the space of 5 minutes in your mind, before you begin your counterattack." "You try to be angry with me, but you can't." "Oh, what a muddle," he said, as if he were cursing. He walked fast ahead of me. The small Florentine street was dreary, like a passageway in a great house, rather than a city street. I longed for the breezes of Venice, or rather my body did, out of habit. I was quite fascinated to be here. "Don't be so provoked," I said. "Why did they turn on Savonarola?"
"Give men enough time and they'll turn on anyone.
He claimed to have been a prophet, divinely inspired by God, and that these were the last days, and this is the oldest, most tiresome Christian complaint in the world, believe you me. The last days. Christianity is a religion based on the notion that we are living in the last days. It's a religion fueled by the ability of men to forget all the blunders of the past and get dressed once more for the last days." I smiled, but bitterly. I wanted to articulate a strong presentment that we were always in the last days, and it was inscribed in our hearts because we were mortals. When quite suddenly and totally, I realized that I was no longer mortal, except in so far as the world itself was mortal. And it seemed I understood more viscerally than ever the atmosphere of purposeful gloom which had overhung my childhood in far-off Kiev. I saw again the muddy catacombs and the half-buried monks who had cheered me on to become one of them. I shook it off, and how bright Florence seemed as we came into the broad, torch-lighted Piazza del Duomo, before the great cathedral of Santa Maria del Fiore.
"Ah, my pupil does listen now and then," Marius was saying to me in an ironic voice. "Yes, I am more than glad that Savonarola is no more. But to rejoice at the end of something is not to approve the endless parade of cruelty that is human history. I wish it were otherwise. Public sacrifice becomes grotesque in every respect. It dulls the senses of the populace. In this city, above all others, it's a spectacle. The Florentines enjoy it, as we do our regattas and processions. So Savonarola is dead. Well, if any mortal man asked for it, it was Savonarola, predicting as he did the end of the world, damning princes from his pulpit, leading great painters to immolate their works. The hell with him.
Master, look, the baptistry, let's go, let's look at the doors. The piazza's almost empty, come on. It's our chance to look at the bronzes.
I tugged on his sleeve. He followed me, and he stopped his muttering, but he was not himself. What I wanted so to see is work that you can see in Florence now, and in fact, almost every treasure of this city and of Venice which I've described here, you can see now. You have only to go there. The panels in the door, which were done by Lorenzo Ghiberti, were my delight. But there was also older work done by Andrea Pisano, portraying the life of St. John the Baptist, and this I didn't intend to overlook. So keen was the vampiric vision that as I studied these various detailed bronze pictures, I could hardly keep from sighing with pleasure. This moment is so clear. I think that I believed then that nothing ever could hurt me or make me sad again, that I had discovered the balm of salvation in the vampiric blood. And the strange thing is that as I dictate this story now, I think the same thing once more. Though unhappy now, and possibly forever, I believe again in the paramount importance of the flesh. My mind wanders to the words of D.H. Lawrence, the 20th-century writer, who in his writings on Italy recalled Blake's image of the tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forests of the night. Lawrence's words are, "This is the supremacy of the flesh which devours all and becomes transfigured into a magnificent brindled flame, a burning bush indeed." This is one way of transfiguration into the eternal flame, the transfiguration through ecstasy in the flesh. But I have done a risky thing here for a storyteller. I have left my plot, as I'm sure the vampire Lestat, who is more skilled perhaps than I am, and so in love with the image of William Blake's Tiger in the Night, and who has, whether he cares to admit it or not, used the tiger in his work in the very same way, would point out to me. And I must speedily return to this moment in the Piazza del Duomo, where I left myself of long ago, standing side by side with Marius, looking at the burnished genius of Ghiberti as he sings in bronze of sibyls and saints. We took our time with these things. Marius said softly that next to Venice, Florence was the city of his choice, for here so much had magnificently flowered. "But I can't be without the sea, not even here," he confided. "And as you see all around you, this city hugs her treasures close with shadowy vigilance, whereas in Venice, the very facades of our palaces are offered up in gleaming stone beneath the moon to Almighty God. "Master, do we serve him?" I pressed. "I know you condemn the monks who brought me up. You condemn the ravings of Savonarola. But do you mean to guide me by another route back to the very same God?"
"That's just it, Amadeo, I do," said Marius. "And I don't mean, as the pagan I am, to admit it so easily, lest its complexity be misunderstood. But I do. I find God in the blood. I find God in the flesh. I find it no accident that the mysterious Christ should reside forever for his followers in the flesh and blood within the bread of the transubstantiation." I was so moved by these words, it seemed the very sun I had forever forsworn had come again to brighten the night. We slipped into the side door of the darkened cathedral called the Duomo. I stood gazing over the long vista of its stone floor towards the altar. Was it possible that I could have the Christ in a new way? Perhaps I had not, after all, renounced him forever. I tried to speak these troubled thoughts to my master. Christ, in a new way. I couldn't explain it, and said finally, "I stumble with my words." "Amadeo, we all stumble, and so do all those who enter history. The concept of a great being stumbles down the centuries. His words and those principles attributed to him do tumble after him. And so the Christ is snatched up in his wandering by the preaching Puritan on one side, the muddy, starving hermit on the other, the gilded Lorenzo de' Medici here, who would celebrate his Lord in gold and paint and mosaic stone."
"But is Christ the living Lord?" I whispered.
No answer. My soul hit a pitch of agony. Marius took my hand and said that we go now, stealthily, to the monastery of San Marco. "This is the sacred house that gave up Savonarola," he said. "We'll slip into it, unbeknownst to its pious inhabitants."
We again traveled as if by magic. I felt only the master's strong arms, and did not even see the frame of the doors as we exited and made our way to this other place. I knew he meant to show me the work of the artist called Fra Angelico, long dead, who had labored all his life in this very monastery, a painter-monk, as I, perhaps, had been destined to be, far away in the lightless monastery of the caves. Within seconds, we sat down soundlessly on the moist grass of the square cloister of San Marco, the serene garden enclosed by Michelozzo's loggias, secure within its walls. At once I heard many prayers reach my inner vampiric hearing, desperate, agitated prayers of the brothers who had been loyal or sympathetic to Savonarola. I put my hands to my head, as if this foolish human gesture could signal to the divine that I had had more than I could bear. My master broke the current of thought reception with his soothing voice.
"Come," he said, grasping my hand. "We'll slip into the cells one by one. There is enough light for you to see the works of this monk."
"You mean that Fra Angelico painted the very cells where monks go to sleep?"
I had thought his works would be in the chapel and in the other public or communal rooms. "That's why I want you to see this," said my master. He led me up a stairs and into a wide stone corridor. He made the first door spring open, and gently we moved inside, fleet and silent, not disturbing the monk who lay curled on his hard bed, his head sweating against the pillow.
"Don't look at his face," said my master gently. "If you do, you'll see the troubled dreams he suffers. I want you to look at the wall. What do you see? Now, look."
I understood at once. This art of Fra Giovanni, called Angelico in honor of his sublime talent, was a strange mixture of the sensuous art of our time with the pious and forswearing art of the past. I gazed on the bright, elegant rendering of the arrest of Christ in the Garden of Gethsemane. The slender, flattened figures resembled very much the elongated and elastic images of the Russian icon, and yet the faces were softened and plastic with genuine and touching emotion. It seemed a kindness infused all beings here, not merely our Lord himself, condemned to be betrayed by one of his own, but the apostles who looked on, and even the unfortunate soldier, in his tunic of mail, who reached out to take the Lord away, and the soldiers watched.
I was transfixed by this unmistakable kindness, this seeming innocence that infected everyone, this sublime compassion on the part of the artist for all players in this tragic drama which had prefaced the salvation of the world. Into another cell I was taken immediately. Once again the door gave way at Marius's command, and the sleeping occupant of the cell never knew that we were there. This painting showed again the Garden of Agony, and Christ, before the arrest, alone among his sleeping apostles, left to beg his heavenly Father for strength. Once again I saw the comparison to the old styles, in which I, as a Russian boy, had felt so sure. The folds in the cloth, the use of arches, the halo for each head, the discipline of the whole, all was connected to the past, and yet there shone again the new Italian warmth, the undeniable Italian love of the humanity of all included, even our Lord himself. We went from cell to cell. Backwards and forwards through the life of Christ we traveled, visiting the scene of the first Holy Communion, in which, so touchingly, Christ gave out the bread containing his body and blood as if it were the host at Mass. And then the Sermon on the Mount, in which the smooth pleated rocks around our Lord and his listeners seemed made of cloth, as surely as his graceful gown. When we came to the crucifixion, in which our Lord gave over to St. John his blessed mother, I was heartstruck by the anguish in the Lord's face. How thoughtful in her distress was the face of the Virgin, and how resigned was the saint beside her, with his soft, fair Florentine face, so like that of a thousand other painted figures in this city, barely fringed with a light brown beard. Just when I thought I understood my master's lessons perfectly, we happened upon another painting, and I would feel yet a stronger connection with the long-ago treasures of my boyhood and the quiet, incandescent splendor of the Dominican monk who had graced these walls. Finally, we left this clean, lovely place of tears and whispered prayers. We went out into the night and back to Venice, traveling in cold and noisy darkness, and arriving at home in time to sit a while in the warm light of the sumptuous bedchamber and talk. "Do you see?" Marius pressed me. He was at his desk with his pen in hand. He dipped it and wrote even as he talked, turning back the large vellum page of his diary. "In far-off Kiev, the cells were the earth itself, moist and pure, but dark and omnivorous, the mouth that eats all life finally, that would bring to ruin all art." I shivered. I sat rubbing the backs of my arms, looking at him. But there in Florence, what did this subtle teacher, Fra Angelico, bequeath to his brothers? Magnificent pictures to put them in mind of the suffering of our Lord? He wrote several lines before he resumed. "Fra Angelico never scorned to delight your eye, to fill your vision with all the colors God has given you the power to see, for you were given by him two eyes, Amadeo, and not to be shut up in the dark earth." I reflected for a long time. To know these things theoretically had been one thing. To have passed through the hushed and sleeping rooms of the monastery, to have seen my master's principles there emblazoned by a monk himself, this was something else. "It is a glorious time, this," Marius said softly. "That which was good among the ancients is now rediscovered and given a new form. You ask me, is Christ the Lord? I say, Amadeo, that he can be, for he never taught anything himself but love, or so his apostles, whether they know it or not, have led us to believe." I waited on him, as I knew he wasn't finished. The room was so sweetly warm and clean and bright. I have near my heart forever a picture of him at this moment, the tall, fair-haired Marius, his red cloak thrown back to free his arm for the pen he held, his face smooth and reflecting, his blue eyes looking, beyond that time and any other in which he had lived, for the truth. The heavy book was propped on a low, portable lectern for him, to give it a comfortable angle. The little inkpot was set inside a richly embellished silver holder, and the heavy candelabra behind him, with its eight thick, melting candles, was made up of numberless engraved cherubs, half embedded in the deeply worked silver, with wings struggling, perhaps, to fly loose, and tiny round-cheeked faces turned this way and that with large, contented eyes beneath loose, serpentine curls. It seemed an audience of little angels to watch and listen as Marius spoke, so many, many tiny faces peering indifferently forth from the silver, quite immune to the falling rivulets of pure, melted wax. "I cannot live without this beauty," I said suddenly, though I had meant to wait. "I cannot endure without it. O God, you have shown me hell, and it lies behind me, surely, in the land where I was born." He heard my little prayer, my little confession, my desperate plea. "If Christ is the Lord," he said, returning to his point, returning us both to the lesson. "If Christ is the Lord, then what a beautiful miracle it is, this Christian mystery." His eyes filmed with tears. "That the Lord himself should come to earth and clothe himself in flesh, the better to know us and to comprehend us. Oh, what God ever made in the image of man by his fancy was ever better than one who would become flesh. Yes, I would say to you, yes, your Christ, their Christ, the Christ even of the monks of Kiev, he is the Lord. Only mark forever the lies they tell in his name and the deeds they do. For Savonarola called on his name when he praised a foreign enemy bearing down on Florence. And those who burnt Savonarola as a false prophet, they too, as they lit the faggots beneath his dangling body, they too called on Christ the Lord." I was overcome with tears. He sat in silence, respecting me, perhaps, or only collecting his thoughts. Then he dipped his pen again and wrote for a long time, much faster than men do, but deftly and gracefully, and never marking out a word. At last he set down the pen. He looked at me and he smiled. "I set out to show you things, and it's never as I plan. I wanted you tonight to see the dangers in this power of flight, that we can too easily transport ourselves to other places, and that this feeling of slipping in and out so easily is a deception of which we must beware. But look how differently it has all gone." I didn't answer him. "I wanted you," he said, "to be a little afraid." "Master," I said, wiping my nose with the back of my hand, "count on me to be properly frightened when the time comes. I'll have this power, I know it. I can feel it now. And for now, I think it's splendid, and because of it, this power, one dark thought falls over my heart." "What is that?" he asked in the kindest way. "You know, I think your angelic face is no more fit for sad things than those faces painted by Fra Angelico. What's this shadow I see? What is this dark thought?" "Take me back there, Master," I said. I trembled, yet I said it. "Let us use your power to cover miles and miles of Europe. Let us go north. Take me back to see that cruel land that has become a purgatorio in my imagination. Take me back to Kiev." He was slow in giving his answer. The morning was coming. He gathered up his cloak and robe, rose from the chair, and took me with him up the stairs to the roof. We could see the distant, already paling waters of the Adriatic, twinkling under the moon and stars, beyond the familiar forest of the masts of the ships. Tiny lights flickered on the distant islands. The wind was mild and full of salt and sea freshness, and a particular deliciousness that comes only when one has lost all fear of the sea. "Yours is a brave request, Amadeo. If you really wish it, tomorrow night we'll begin the journey." "Have you ever traveled so far before?" "In miles, in space, yes, many times," he said. "But in another's quest for understanding? No, never so very far." He embraced me and took me to the palazzo where our tomb lay hidden. I was cold all over by the time we reached the soiled stone stairway where so many of the poor slept. We picked our way among them until we reached the entrance to the cellar. "Light the torch for me, sir," I said. "I am shivering. I want to see the gold around us, if I may." "There you have it," he said. We stood in our crypt with the two ornate sarcophagi before us. I lay my hand on the lid of the one which was mine. And quite suddenly there came over me another presentiment, that all I loved would endure for a very brief time. Marius must have seen this hesitation. He passed his right hand through the very fire of the torch and touched his warm fingers to my cheek. Then he kissed me where this warmth hovered, and his kiss was warm. Chapter 10. It took us 4 nights to reach Kiev. Only in the early hours before dawn did we hunt. We made our graves in actual burial places, the dungeon vaults of old neglected castles, and in the sepulchres beneath forlorn and ruined churches, where the profane were wont now to stash their livestock and their hay. There are tales I could tell of this journey, of those brave fortresses we roamed near morning, of those wild mountain villages where we found the evil-doer in his rude den. Naturally, Marius saw lessons in all this, teaching me how easy it was to find hiding places, and approving the speed with which I moved through the dense forest, and had no fear of the scattered primitive settlements which we visited on account of my thirst. He praised me that I didn't shrink from the dark, dusty nests of bones in which we lay down by day, reminding me that these burial places, having already been pillaged, were the least likely for men to trouble, even in the light of the sun. Our fancy Venetian clothes were soon streaked with dirt, but we were provided with thick, fur-lined cloaks for the journey, and these covered all. Even in this, Marius saw a lesson, that we must remember what fragile and meaningless protection our garments provide. Mortal men forget how to wear their garments lightly, and that they are a mere covering for the body and no more. Vampires must never forget it, for we are far less dependent upon our raiment than men. By the last morning before our arrival in Kiev, I knew the rocky northern woods only too well. The dread winter of the north was all around us. We had come upon one of the most intriguing of all my memories, the presence of snow. "It no longer hurts me to hold it," I said, gathering the soft, delicious cold snow in my hands and pressing it to my face. "It no longer chills me to see it, and indeed how beautiful it is, covering the poorest of towns and hovels with its blanket. Master, look! Look how it throws back the light even of the weakest stars." We were on the edge of the land that men call the Golden Horde, the southern steppes of Russia, which for 200 years, since the conquest of Genghis Khan, had been too dangerous for the farmer, and often the death of the army or the night. Kiev Rus had once included this fertile and beautiful prairie, stretching far to the east, almost to Europe, as well as south of the city of Kiev, where I had been born. "The final stretch will be nothing," my master told me. "We make it tomorrow night so that you will be rested and fresh when you catch the first sight of home." As we stood on a rocky crag, looking out at the wild grass flowing in the winter wind beneath us, for the first time in the night since I'd become a vampire, I felt a terrible longing for the sun. I wanted to see this land by the light of the sun. I didn't dare confess it to my master. After all, how many blessings can a being want? On the final night, I awoke just after sunset. We had found a hiding place beneath the floor of a church, in a village where no one lived now at all. The horrid Mongol hordes, which had destroyed my homeland over and over again, had long ago burnt this town to nothing, or so Marius had told me, and this church did not even possess a roof. There had been no one left here to pull the stones of the floor away for profit or building, and so we had gone down a forgotten stairway to lie with monks buried here some 1,000 years ago. Rising from the grave, I saw high above a rectangle of sky where my master had removed a marble paving block, an inscribed tombstone, no doubt, for me to make my ascent. I propelled myself upwards, that is, I bent my knees and, using all my strength, shot upwards as if I could fly and passed through this opening to land on my feet. Marius, who invariably rose before me, was sitting nearby. He immediately gave out the expected appreciative laugh. "Have you been saving that little trick for such a moment?" he said. I was dazed by the snow as I looked around me. How afraid I was, merely looking at the frozen pines that had everywhere sprung up on the ruins of the village. I could scarce speak. "No," I managed to say. "I didn't know I could do it. I don't know how high I can leap or how much strength I have. You're pleased, however?" "Yes, why shouldn't I be? I want you to be so strong that no one can ever hurt you." "And who would, master? We travel the world, but who even knows when we go and when we come?" "There are others, Amadeo, and there are others here.
I can hear them if I want to, but there is a good reason for not hearing them.
I understood. You open your mind to hear them, and they know you are there?
Yes, clever one. Are you ready now to go home?
I closed my eyes. I made the sign of the cross in our old way, touching the right shoulder before the left. I thought of my father. We were in the wild fields, and he stood high in his stirrups with his giant bow, the bow only he could bend, like unto the mythical Ulysses, shooting arrow after arrow at the raiders who thundered down on us, riding as if he were one of the Turks or Tatars himself, so great was his skill. Arrow after arrow, drawn out with a swift snap from the pouch on his back, went into the bow and was shot across the high blowing grass, even as his horse galloped at full speed. His red beard was blowing in the fierce wind, and the sky was so blue, so richly blue, that— I broke off this prayer and almost lost my balance. My master held me.
"Pray you'll be finished with all this very quickly," he said.
"Give me your kisses," I said. "Give me your love. Give me your arms as you always have. I need them. Give me your guidance. But give me your arms, yes. Let me rest my head against you. I need you, yes. Yes, I want it to be quick and done, and all its lessons in here, in my mind, to be taken back home."
He smiled. "Home is Venice now? You've made the decision so soon?"
"Yes, I know it even at this moment. What lies beyond is the birthland, and that's not always home. Shall we go?"
Gathering me in his arms, he took to the air. I shut my eyes, even forfeiting my last glimpse of the motionless stars. I seemed to sleep against him, dreamlessly and fearlessly. Then he set me down on my feet. At once I knew this great dark hill, and the leafless oak forest with its frozen black trunks and skeletal branches. I could see the gleaming strip of the Dnieper River far below. My heart scudded inside me. I looked about for the bleak towers of the high city, the city we called Vladimir's City, which was old Kiev. Piles of rubble, which had once been city walls, were only yards from where I stood. I led the way, easily climbing over them and wandering among the ruined churches, churches which had been of legendary splendor when Batu Khan had burnt the city in the year 1240. I had grown up among this jungle of ancient churches and broken monasteries, often hurrying to hear Mass in our Cathedral of Santa Sofia, one of the few monuments which the Mongols had spared. In its day, it had been a spectacle of golden domes, dominating all those of the other churches, and was rumored to be more grand than its namesake in faraway Constantinople, being larger and packed with treasures. What I had known was a stately remnant, a wounded shell. I didn't want to enter the church now. It was enough to see it from the outside, because I knew now, from my happy years in Venice, just what the glory of this church had once been. I understood from the splendid Byzantine mosaics and paintings of San Marco, and from the old Byzantine church on the Venetian island of Torcello, what glory had once been here for all to see. When I thought of the lively crowds of Venice, her students, scholars, lawyers, merchants, I could paint a dense vitality on this bleak and wasted scene. The snow was deep and thick, and few Russians were out in it this frigid early evening, so we had it to ourselves, walking through it with ease, not having to pick our way as mortals would. We came to a long stretch of ruined battlement, a shapeless guardrail now beneath the snow, and standing there, I looked down on the lower city, the city we called Podol, the only real city of Kiev that remained, the city where, in a rough timber and clay house only a few yards from the river, I had grown up. I looked down on deep-pitched roofs, their thatch covered in cleansing snow, their chimneys smoking, and on narrow, crooked, snow-filled streets. A great grid of such houses and other buildings had long ago formed against the river and managed to survive fire after fire and even the worst Tatar raids. It was a town made up of traders and merchants and craftsmen, all bound to the river and the treasures she brought from the Orient, and the money some would pay for the goods she took south into the European world. My father, the indomitable hunter, had traded bear skins which he himself had brought back single-handed from the interior of the great forest which spread towards the north. Fox, marten, beaver, sheep.
all these skins he had dealt in. So great was his strength and luck that no man or woman of our household ever sold their handiwork or wanted for food. If we starved, and we had starved, it was because the winter ate the food, and the meat was gone, and there was nothing for my father's gold to buy. I caught the stench of Podl as I stood on the battlements of Vladimir's city. I caught the stench of rotting fish and livestock, of soiled flesh and river mud. I pulled my fur cloak around me, blowing the snow off the fur when it came up to my lips, and I looked back up at the dark domes of the cathedral against the sky. "Let's walk on. Let's go past the castle of the Voivode," I said. "You see that wooden building? You would never call it a palace or a castle in fair Italy. That is a castle here." Marius nodded. He made a little soothing gesture. I owed him no explanation of this alien place from which I'd come. The Voivode was our ruler, and in my time it had been Prince Michael of Lithuania. I didn't know who it would be now. I surprised myself that I used the proper word for him. In my deathly dream vision, I had no consciousness of language, and the strange word for ruler, Voivode, had never passed my lips. But I had seen him clearly then in his round, black fur hat, his dark, thick velvet tunic, and his felt boots. I led the way. We approached the squat building, which seemed more a fortress than anything else, built as it was out of such enormous logs. Its walls had a graceful slope as they ascended. Its many towers had four-tiered roofs. I could see its central roof, a great five-sided wooden dome of sorts, in stark outline against the starry sky. Torches blazed at its huge doorways and along the outer walls of its enclosures. All its windows were sealed against the winter and the night. Time was when I thought it was the grandest building yet standing in Christendom. It was no task at all to dazzle the guards with a few swift, soft words and darting movements, to pass them and to enter the castle itself. We found our way in by means of a rear storage room, and quietly made our way to a vantage point where we could spy upon the small crowd of fur-trimmed nobles or lords who clustered in the great room, beneath the bare beams of a wooden ceiling around the roaring fire. On a great sprawling mass of brilliant Turkey rugs they sat, in huge Russian chairs, whose geometrical carvings were no mystery to my eye. They drank from gold goblets, the wine being provided by two leather-clad serving boys, and their long belted robes were the colors of blue and red and gold, as bright as the many designs in the rugs. European tapestries covered the rudely stuccoed walls. Same old scenes of the hunt in the never-ending woodlands of France or England or Tuscany. On a long board set with blazing candles, sat a simple meal of joints and fowl. So cold was the room that these lords wore their Russian fur hats. How exotic it had looked to me in boyhood, when I'd been brought with my father to stand before Prince Michael, who was eternally grateful for my father's feats of bravery in bringing down delicious game in the wild fields, or delivering bundles of valuables to the allies of Prince Michael in the Lithuanian forts to the west. But these were Europeans. I had never respected them. My father had taught me too well that they were but lackeys of the Khan, paying for the right to rule us. "No one goes up against those thieves," my father had said, "so let them sing their songs of honor and valor. It means nothing. You listen to the songs that I sing." And my father could sing some songs. For all his stamina in the saddle, for all his dexterity with the bow and arrow, and his blunt brute force with the broadsword, he had the ability with his long fingers to pluck out music on the strings of an old harp and sing with cleverness the narrative songs of the ancient times, when Kiev had been a great capital, her churches rivaling those of Byzantium, her riches the wonder of all the world. Within a moment I was ready to go. I took one last memorial glance at these men, huddled as they were over their golden wine cups, their big fur-trimmed boots resting on fancy Turkish footrests, their shoulders hunkered, their shadows crowding the walls. And then, without their ever having known we were there, we slipped away. It was time now to go to the other hilltop city, the Pechersk, under which lay the many catacombs of the Monastery of the Caves. I trembled at the mere thought of it. It seemed the mouth of the monastery would swallow me, and I should burrow through the moist Mother Earth, forever seeking the light of the stars, never to find my way out. But I went there, trudging through the mud and snow, and again with a vampire's silky ease I gained access, this time leading the way, snapping the locks silently with my superior strength, and lifting the doors as I opened them so no weight would fall upon their creaky hinges, and dashing swiftly across rooms so that mortal eyes perceived no more than cold shadows, if they perceived anything at all. The air was warm and motionless here, a blessing, but memory told me it had not been so terribly warm for a mortal boy. In the scriptorium, by the smoky light of cheap oil, several brothers were bent over their slanted desks, working on their copying, as if the printing press were of no concern to them, and surely it was not. I could see the texts on which they worked, and I knew them. The Patericon of the Kievan Caves Monastery, with its marvelous tales of the monastery's founders and its many colorful saints. In this room, laboring over that text, I had learned fully to read and write. I crept now along the wall until my eyes could fall on the page which one monk copied, his left hand steadying the crumbling model from which he worked. I knew this part of the Patericon by heart. It was the tale of Isaac. Demons had fooled Isaac. They had come to him as beautiful angels, and even pretending to be Christ himself. When Isaac had fallen for their tricks, they had danced with glee and taunted him. But after much meditation and penance, Isaac stood up to these demons. The monk had just dipped his pen, and he wrote now the words with which Isaac spoke. "When you deceived me in the form of Jesus Christ and the angels, you were unworthy of that rank. But now you appear in your true colors." I looked away. I didn't read the rest. Cleaving there so well to the wall, I might have gone on unseen forever. Slowly, I looked at the other pages which the monk had copied, which were being let to dry. I found an earlier passage, which I'd never forgotten, describing Isaac as he lay, withdrawn from all the world, motionless, and without food for 2 years. "For Isaac was weakened in mind and body and could not turn over on his side, stand up, or sit down. He just lay there on one side, and often worms collected under his thighs from his excrement and urine." The demons had driven Isaac to this with their deception. Such temptations, such visions, such confusion and such penance I myself had hoped to experience for the rest of my life when I entered here as a child. I listened to the pen scratch on the paper. I withdrew, unseen, as if I'd never come. I looked back at my scholarly brethren. All were emaciated, dressed in cheap black wool, reeking of old sweat and dirt, and their heads were all but shaved. Their long beards were thin and uncombed. I thought I knew one of them, had loved him somewhat even, but this seemed remote and not worth considering any more. To Marius, who stood beside me as faithfully as a shadow, I confided that I could not have endured it. But we both knew this was a lie. In all likelihood I would have endured it, and I would have died without ever knowing any other world. I moved into the first of the long tunnels where the monks were buried, and, closing my eyes and cleaving to the mud wall, I listened for the dreams and prayers of those who lay entombed alive for the love of God. It was nothing but what I could imagine, and exactly as I recalled. I heard the familiar, no longer mysterious words whispered in the church Slavonic. I saw the prescribed images. I felt the sputtering flame of true devotion and true mysticism, kindled from the weak fire of lives of utter denial. I stood with my head bowed. I let my temple rest against the mud. I wished to find the boy, so pure of soul, who had opened these cells to bring the hermits just enough food and drink to keep them alive. But I couldn't find the boy. I couldn't. And I felt only a raging pity for him that he had ever suffered here, thin and miserable and desperate and ignorant. Oh, so terribly ignorant, having but one sensuous joy in life, and that was to see the colors of the icon catch fire. I gasped. I turned my head and fell stupidly into Marius's arms. "Don't cry, Amadeo," he said tenderly in my ear. He brushed my hair from my eyes, and with his soft thumb he even wiped away my tears. "Tell it all farewell now, son," he said. I nodded. In a twinkling we stood outside. I didn't speak to him. He followed me. I headed down the slope towards the waterfront city. The smell of the river grew stronger, the stench of humans grew stronger, and finally I came to the house that I knew had been my own. What madness this seemed suddenly! What was I seeking? To measure all this by new standards? To confirm for myself that as a mortal child I had never had the slightest chance? Dear God, there was no justification for what I was. An impious blood-drinker, feeding off the luxurious stews of the wicked Venetian world. I knew it. Was this all a vain exercise in self-justification? No, something else pulled me towards the long rectangular house, like so many others, its thick clay walls divided by rough timbers, its four-tiered roof dripping with icicles, this large and crude house that was my home. As soon as we reached it, I crept around the sides. The slush of the snow had here turned to water, and indeed the water of the river leaked down the street and into everywhere as it had when I was a child. The water leaked into my fine-stitched Venetian boots, but it could not paralyze my feet as it had once done, because I drew my strength now from gods unknown here, and creatures for whom these filthy peasants, of which I had been one, had no name. I lay my head against the rough wall, just as I had done in the monastery, cleaving to the mortar as if the solidity would protect me and transmit to me all that I wanted to know. I could see through a tiny hole in the broken clumps of clay that were forever crumbling, and I beheld in the familiar blaze of candles and the brighter light of lamps a family gathered around the warmth of the large brick stove. I knew them all, these people, though some of their names were gone from my mind. I knew that they were kindred, and I knew the atmosphere that they shared. But I had to see beyond this little gathering. I had to know if these people were well. I had to know if after that fateful day, when I'd been kidnapped, and my father no doubt murdered in the wild lands, they had managed to go on with their usual vigor. I had to know, perhaps, what they prayed when they thought of André, the boy with the gift to make icons so perfectly, icons not made by human hands. I heard the harp inside. I heard singing. The voice was that of one of my uncles, and so young he might have been my brother. His name was Boris, and he had since early childhood been good with singing, memorizing easily the old dumis, or sagas, of the knights and heroes, and it was one of them, very rhythmical and tragic, which he was singing now. The harp was small and old, my father's harp, and Boris strummed the strings in time with his phrases, as he all but spoke the story of a lusty and fatal battle for ancient and great Kiev. I heard the familiar cadences that had been passed down by our people from singer to singer for hundreds of years. I put my fingers up and broke loose a bit of mortar. I saw through the tiny opening the icon corner, directly opposite the family gathering around the shimmering fire in the open stove. Ah, what a spectacle! Amid dozens of little candle stubs and earthen lamps full of burning fat, there stood propped some 20 or more icons, some very old and darkened in their gold frames, and some radiant, as though only yesterday they'd come alive through the power of God. There were painted eggs stuffed amongst the pictures, eggs beautifully decorated and colored with patterns I could well recall, though even with my vampire eyes I was too far away to see them now. Many times I had watched the women decorating these sacred eggs for Easter, applying the hot melting wax to them with their wooden pens to mark the ribbons or the stars or the crosses or the lines, which meant the ram's horns, or the symbol which meant the butterfly or the stork. Once the wax had been applied, the egg would be dipped in cold dye of amazingly deep color. It had seemed there was an endless variety and endless possibility for meaning in these simple patterns and signs. These fragile and beautiful eggs were kept for curing the sick, or for protection against the storm. I had hidden such eggs in an orchard for good luck with the coming harvest. I had placed one once over the door of the house in which my sister went to live as a young bride. There was a beautiful story about these decorated eggs, that as long as the custom was followed, as long as such eggs existed, then the world would be safe from the monster of evil, who wanted always to come and devour all that was. It was sweet to see these eggs placed there in the proud corner of the icons, as always, among the holy faces. That I had forgotten this custom seemed a shame and a warning of tragedy to come. But the holy faces caught me suddenly, and I forgot all else. I saw the face of Christ blazing in the firelight, my brilliant, scowling Christ, as I had so often painted him. I had done so many of these pictures, And yet how like the one lost that day in the high grasses of the wild lands was this very one? But that was impossible. How could anyone have recovered the icon I had dropped when the raiders took me prisoner? No, it must surely be another, for as I said, I had done so many before my parents had ever gotten up the courage to take me to the monks. Why, all through this town were my icons. My father had even brought them to Prince Michael as proud gifts, and it was the prince who had said that the monks must see my skill. How stern our Lord looked now, compared to the recollection of the tender musing Christs of Fra Angelico, or the noble, sorrowful Lord of Bellini. And yet he was warm with my love. He was the Christ in our style, the old style, loving in severe lines, loving in somber color, loving in the manner of my land. And he was warm with the love that I believed he gave to me. A sickness rose up in me. I felt my master's hands on my shoulders. He didn't pull me back as I feared. He merely held me and put his cheek against my hair. I was about to go. It was enough. Was it now? But the music broke off. A woman there. My mother, was she? No, younger. My sister Anya, grown into a woman, talked wearily of how my father could sing again if somehow they could hide all the liquor from him and make him come back to himself. My uncle Boris sneered. Ivan was hopeless, said Boris. Ivan would never see another sober night or day, and would soon die. Ivan was poisoned with liquor, both with the fine spirits he got from the traders by selling off what he stole from this very house, and from the peasant brew he got from those he battered and bullied, still being the terror of the town. I bristled all over. Ivan, my father, alive? Ivan, alive to die again in such dishonor? Ivan, not slain in the wild fields? But in their thick skulls, the thoughts of him and the words of him stopped together. My uncle sang another song, a dancing song. No one would dance in this house, where all were tired from their labor, and the women half blind as they continued to mend the clothes that lay piled in their laps. But the music cheered them, and one of them, a boy younger than I had been when I died, yes, my little brother, whispered a soft prayer for my father, that my father would not freeze to death tonight, as he had almost done so many times, falling down drunk as he did in the snow. "Please bring him home," came the little boy's whisper. Then, behind me, I heard Marius say, seeking to put it in order and to calm me, "Yes, it seems it is true, beyond doubt. Your father is alive." Before he could caution me, I went around and opened the door.